Case number 13-7027, Stephanie Y. Brown, appellant versus Alan L. Sessoms, president, University District of Columbia et al. Mr. Temple for the appellant, Ms. Pack for the appellees.
Mr. Temple, good morning. Before you start, we were informed by our deputy clerk that we don't have any air conditioning, so it may get rather stuffy in here. We're trying to do something about it, but we haven't intentionally turned off the air. Go ahead.
I may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Donald Temple, and I represent the appellant, Stephanie Brown, professor of law at UDC School of Law. We're here to seek a reversal of the lower court decision on several grounds, and they include the following: that the motion to dismiss was erroneously granted, the pleadings below satisfied the Iqbal Twombly standard, it satisfied the Jett Monell standard. We allege properly a policy made by final decision makers, to wit, the provost of the school, the president of the school, and the board of trustees, which sanctioned and ratified the behavior, which I will outline further. Additionally, we outlined in our pleadings and showed that the plaintiff established and satisfied the McDonnell-Douglas standards, that she was a member of a protected class, that she was treated differently. And on that point, we outlined 30 different provisions in the complaint with the objective to show a totally different treatment between herself during a particular time period and a substantially similar situated fellow white male employee on the question of tenure, and a totally different application of this of the tenure question.
Before you do that, could you address the issue that we asked you to address by order yesterday? That is, you brought a 1981 claim without a 1983, and the Supreme Court in Jett said can't do that, and how the district court had jurisdiction. Well, it had supplementary jurisdiction. Why we shouldn't remand it to send it back to
on that particular question,
Superior Court,
which speaks to the Monell issues and the Jett case, and is as well a case that this court actually rendered on September the 12th last week, the Singletary case versus versus the District of Columbia. In 1981 cases, the practice is to treat 1981 cases in a manner, even when they are not 1983 claims alleged, whereas the plaintiff has to establish a policy and custom. And in this particular case, the plaintiff has alleged the policy and custom that's consistent with the requirement of establishing liability against the municipality.
Are you talking about the Singletary case or your case?
Yes, the in this case. Singletary case, the court held that it didn't. But it's our view that we did establish the 1983-based type custom and policy.
I guess the question, though, is not just whether you've alleged a policy or custom, and let's just bracket that for 1 second. The question is whether you had to do so through a 1983 action.
Whether we had to specifically allege a 1983 action.
Right, because I thought the way Jett has been construed is that 1981 itself doesn't confer a cause of action, so the cause of action comes from 1983. And so in order to win on the merits, we can address whether this is a jurisdictional question or a merits question, but at least in order to win on the merits, you'd have to do so by pairing 1981 with a 1983 action.
I saw that and did extensive research on that question, and the cases had a mixed response, because there were 1981 cases where there were not 1983 actions alleged. And in lieu of the allegation, the court viewed that nonetheless as having to meet the threshold standard of a 1983 claim.
And so even though the only thing that was brought was a 1981
even though the only claim that was brought was a 1981 claim.
Which cases do that? Do you know?
I'm not certain, but I think that in the
well, Well, I don't want to sidetrack you unnecessarily, yeah. but you have seen those cases, and I guess maybe even in...
I absolutely have seen those cases, and I don't have them at this particular point. Okay. It either is or it isn't, but if it is, and if I'm correct, then I think that the pleadings go the 1983 route relative to the Jet Liner cases and Monell cases in terms of the establishment of the final decision makers, which we pled, the policies that were in existence, which we pled and which were violated, and the causal relationship between the policies and Professor Brown's and the denial of termination, denial of tenure, and the termination that followed.
Is it your understanding that suppose that one were to conclude that you didn't allege a customer policy sufficiently, even assuming that you didn't have to do it via 1983, that bringing in under 1981 alone is enough, and you didn't get past the bar on customer policy, does that go to subject matter jurisdiction or does that go to the merits?
I think it goes to the merits.
And there, do you have?
I mean, to the extent that the question of whether or not there are policies in place is a question of fact that have to be.
I think Bell versus Hood establishes that federal courts have jurisdiction to hear claims that a particular cause of action exists, even if that claim is mistaken. And so I think that preserves our and the district court's jurisdiction over your claim, assuming a ruling against you on this relationship between 1981 and 1983.
Yes, I don't necessarily disagree.
No, it would be strange if you did.
So on that particular question, I operate on the premise that the 1981 claims sufficed, and that we extensively, for purposes of it being a motion to dismiss, which was treated almost as a motion for summary judgment on the documents, that we extensively alleged the policy. We outlined the policy very carefully, and we outlined it in both our 1981 and our DC human rights claims, and that these policies, that there was, in fact, this huge question of this merger issue, and the fact that the merger had not been passed into law, and that the president made a final decision effectively, and that there is no, and that final decision was an aberration when, on the other hand, within the same time period, the Board of Trustees, in the consideration of William McLean's tenure, which is in 2010, stated definitively that the board is making that decision, and so there's a totally different treatment of one person who's black and one person who's white. And we think that for purposes of the threshold, that particular policy is made in June by the provost and ratified by the president. And so, along with the other 25 allegations that support that, which are fact intense, we believe that the plaintiff established the threshold, particularly on the 1981, but not only the 1981, on the negligent supervision claim and on the breach of contract claims. And so I'll reserve, my time is quickly expiring, and I'll reserve the balance of time for rebuttal.
All right, Ms. Pack.
May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors. With me at counsel's table is Smoody Radker, Assistant General Counsel for UDC. Your Honor, to jump directly to the question that the court asked the parties, the counsel, to address, we believe that under JET that the 1981 claim that's been brought by plaintiff must be dismissed because she did not plead, or JET holds that she must bring a claim under 1983, and that's her exclusive remedy when she's bringing a claim of a 1981 violation against a state actor. I believe that this court directly addressed that issue in a per curiam unpublished decision that was issued in 2006, and that's the Quick Serve Food versus WMATA case, which is found at 2006 U.S. APP Lexus 28692. And we believe, Your Honor, that opinion was a per curiam opinion that was issued that essentially stated that in accordance with Jett, that the 1981 action must be dismissed because corresponding 1983 action was not brought at the same time.
And then if the 1981 action is dismissed on those grounds, I take it you mean dismissal on the merits?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so there's still supplemental jurisdiction over the other claims?
Yes, Your Honor. That's why we would assert supplemental jurisdiction over the other claims, and that the court can continue with its consideration of the matter.
And the district court could, perhaps would have to, grant leave to amend the complaint?
That is certainly a possibility, Your Honor, within the district court's discretion. But we believe, Your Honor, that amendment would be futile. I think that we've seen the complaint's already been amended once before the district court. The allegations that were made really boil down to whether or not there was a breach of contract. The plaintiffs rely on both the faculty handbook.
Well, that's true on the contract claims, but it's not on the discrimination claim.
Well, I think what Judge Leon found in the lower court was that the discrimination claim really was a restatement of the contract claim, and it's based on what they allege is a breach of the contract. This boils down to what's the proper procedure with respect to the tenure review decisions.
It's a very explicit claim of different treatment of a person on grounds of race and sex.
Right, but... Absolutely, Your Honor, and that consideration boils down to the procedures that and the.
I thought it related to the outcome, the substantive decision.
Right, Your Honor, I don't disagree. I think that there was substantive claims of discrimination that were made, but I believe that the way the district court's opinion read was that it all boiled down to, well, what's the proper procedure that needs to be in place and what's the criteria, and that boils down.
I'm not quite sure I follow that. What more was the plaintiff supposed to do on the discrimination claim in order to survive, in your view?
Well, I think I apologize, Your Honor. I think, Your Honor, it wasn't about what more she had to do. I think when you look at the allegations that she made, she pled enough so that she actually pled herself out of a claim under the standards established by Trudeau. I think that you have to look at both facts, that maybe whether you say it's good for the plaintiff or bad for the plaintiff. You take both facts that may be adverse or supporting the plaintiff's position, you have to assume all those facts is true, and that's what Judge Leon did in the district court.
I'm not quite sure I follow. So she makes the allegation that I was denied tenure, that I'm a member of a protected class, I suffered an adverse consequence because I was denied tenure. I was denied tenure on the basis of my membership in a protected class, and another individual who was similarly situated to me got treated better. And further, they're similarly situated to me, but they got treated better even though they didn't have any publications and I did. So that, as I understand it, those are the kind of nuts and bolts of what she alleges in her cause of action for discrimination. And my question is, what more was she supposed to do to surmount Iqbal and Twombly, in your view? How does that fall short?
I don't believe that, Your Honor, I don't think that we can reasonably say it did fall short, but I think the substance of the allegation is neither candidate may have been qualified for the position, so they weren't actually similarly situated. He was outside of the protected class. We're talking about the plaintiff is an African-American female, that her comparator is a white male. And I believe the allegations below was that either they were both qualified and he was treated better, or that they were both unqualified and he was given credit for his scholarship through the illegal work that he did that she doesn't otherwise claim that she had. So the allegation that's being made is Professor McLean, who's the comparator in this case, he may not have had the three publications that she alleges that she also didn't have, but he also had other work that were given credit towards that scholarship. She, on the other hand, did not at the time of her application.
So she had other things that she invoked in addition to scholarship, so there may be questions on the weight and quality of them, but just superficially, it's not clear that he was in any way ahead of her to be preferred to her on the merits.
And Your Honor, I think that what Judge Leon was doing was trying to defer to the tenure committee's recommendation and decision, as well as the university's decision. I think she had pled that that substitutes were made in terms of credit for the various criteria that the committee and the university may have considered. And under the case law that we've cited in our brief, there is certain deference that's given to universities and the decision makers at the universities with respect to tenure decisions. I think that even just based on the pleadings, we don't have a record in this case yet, but just based on the pleadings, neither candidate had the precise qualifications, but if the judgment was made by the university to allow for credit based on other quality work, that was a decision I think that Judge Leon deferred to.
It sounds in the nature of an argument that's past the pleading stage. I mean, we're talking about what you do with just with the pleadings alone, and as you yourself have said, we don't have a record yet. So it may be that some of what you say is what's going to be borne out once evidence is submitted and somebody has a chance to assess the credibility of the witnesses and assay the evidence. But without any of that, the allegation's been made that somebody who was similarly situated to me got treated better, with a particular fact that, at least without knowing more, we don't know the evidence, but would bolster that, which is to say that that person had no publications and I had some. And it just as a matter of pleadings, you have to show that she can't prevail under that set of allegations, under the pleadings. And I don't know how you get there.
I'm not sure if we have, I think, Your Honor, with the pleading, I guess, with the requirement is that we're given notice of the claim. We have been given notice that it's an employment discrimination claim, of course, right? I think that basic requirement's been made. When you look at the pleadings as a whole, and you look at the facts that may or may not support her position, and when you just look at the four corners of the complaint, there were facts that supported her allegations, and there was a fact that didn't support her cause of action for discrimination. I think Judge Leon balanced the two and made a credibility determination. I can't say he made a credibility determination.
Right,
he can. Right.
That's the point, I think.
His analysis of the allegations, just based on the pleadings, was you've pled too much. I think you're basically telling me that there's not a discrimination complaint here. So it's not about adequate pleading, but have you pled too much that you've essentially tipped your hand and told me that you don't have a claim?
Surplus? I don't get that. How is it that she pled too much?
I think that it comes down to the credit being given for other work, other legal work that's substituted for the scholarship requirement.
Yeah, but then there's other legal work on both sides, and presumably a rational employer considers the quality and quantity of both.
Well, I think that, Your Honor, is the key. She doesn't allege she's got the other legal work that balances out what Professor McLean was given credit for. She has the tenure at the university. She had all this other service that she's done. She's been in different capacities with the law school since late 90s, I believe. But what the committee did and what she doesn't plead is that I had other work that the committee could have given me scholarship credit for, but they didn't.
I thought she talks about the service that she provided to the university.
Oh, absolutely. And we don't dispute that that's her history with the university, but it comes down to this single criteria of scholarship. Professor McLean, neither candidate had three publications, and I think that's made clear in the pleadings. But she also pleads.
Are you saying there's some rule in the university that legal work can offset a deficiency in scholarship, but not the things that she was doing? I never saw anything like that.
The handbook that's in the excerpt of the handbook that's in the joint appendix, Your Honor, does talk about substituting legal work for the scholarship credit. I could go back and look and pinpoint the paragraph for you. And it's a balancing act of the three different criteria that had been considered by the committee and by the university. And what she doesn't plead is that she had equal or more of the substitute work or the other work that she could have been given credit for.
What if she files a complaint that just says there's three criteria? This seems somewhat artificially precise to me. But suppose she does file a complaint that says there's three criteria. I have no idea on earth what happened with the other two. What I can tell you is with respect to the first one, I was better qualified than the other person, but I was treated adversely because of my membership in a protected class. And in fact, I have a memo that says that the decision maker concluded that I should be treated less favorably on this one criteria because of my membership in a protected class. And I'm not exactly sure what happened with the other two, but this is my claim of race discrimination or gender discrimination. Is that not enough in your view because there's these two other criteria, even though there will have been a specific allegation that says as to one criteria that matters with respect to the result, I was treated unfavorably because of my membership in a protected class, and there's direct evidence of that?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't say that would be insufficient. I think I don't think that we'd be in a position to say you have not pled enough under those type of circumstances.
Then I'm not quite sure how this case is meaningfully different because, although I'm obviously constructing a hypothetical that involves direct evidence, the point is still that it's evidence that's going to one of, by your description, three criteria, the other two criteria of which we don't have evidence yet. But I'm still making an allegation as to this one criteria, and I'm still saying that this one criteria bore on the ultimate decision. And as to this criteria, there was discrimination.
Well, what is fatal to her claim and the allegation is that when she says Professor McLean had other legal work for which she was given credit, she needs to level the playing field and say, I also had that other work that I could have been given credit for, but she doesn't do that. She relies on the one publication she had and the two in progress at the time of the application. I know there was, at a later time that the publications were, the two others were published. But at the time, she doesn't make the allegation that they were equal and similarly situated. She didn't have that other work to give her the quality work that the committee could consider. She pled in her complaint that Professor McLean had that other work, the legal work, that was sufficient as determined by the committee to be substituted for the publication requirement. So because the pleadings are off and off, and not in balance, to place them into the similarly situated category, I think that's what Judge Leon was looking at to say you haven't pled a discrimination complaint. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Temple has.
Just very quickly, I would direct the court to footnote 6 of the defendant's motion, where they talk about the law review articles, and joint appendix 156, where the letter specifically states to Professor Brown, you have not met the standards for tenure, which are the law review articles, when at that particular point she did. And that particular point, that provost had been sitting on Professor Brown's unanimous recommendation from FERC, based on her scholarly work, and directing your attention to paragraph 18 of our amended complaint, her extraordinary service in maintaining and developing the university. So there was, in fact, a double standard. What counsel is stating relative to Professor McLean is not true. We did not plead that he had some comparable service record. We don't know. What we do know is that based on the evidence that we have is that she was treated absolutely different. The ice cream cone for the white male was $1. The ice cream cone for the black woman was $2. And that, based on 1981 and based on Title VII practice and principle, is a different test. And they have in the staff. And I don't think we have to prove our case at this particular point in time. The court injected credibility determinations, made lots of findings based on facts that we haven't had a chance to develop. We filed a Rule 56 affidavit as well, given the fact that we haven't had a chance to consider the factual issues in the case. And with that, given my time is expired fairly, we submit.
All right. Thank you.